Hey, scaredy cats. We are about to embark on a road trip along the back roads of rural Texas. A little piece of advice, though, perhaps don't go wandering off on your own. You might just run into the Sawyer family, and trust me when I say that you do not want to run into this family. If you do, you may end up hanging from a meat hook before being served up for tonight's dinner. It is time to talk about the 1974 horror classic, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
What happened was true.
Joining us as we try to escape from cannibalistic Texans are Ryan, Derek, and Samantha, because you know we had to have a Texan. Hey, folks, how are you tonight?
Hello.
Pretty good.
Yeah, I'm doing well.
You can't forget the other two rules of don't pick up a hitchhiker and don't enter someone's house.
Yeah, both bad ideas.
Especially in Texas. Like, this is you get to protect your property state. Like, don't just walk in. You're going to get shot or hit or something. Just don't do it.
That's a good point.
Why don't you each take a second and introduce yourselves?
I'm Samantha. I am just the horror junkie accountant from Texas. Been on here a few times, so y'all know by now if you're a regular listener that I am kind of a weirdo, but hey, I embrace it.
I'm Ryan, and regular listeners of the show will know I'm the Stephen King fanatic of the group. I'm a horror illustrator, I guess you would say, and a real bookworm. So I don't watch a lot of movies these days anymore. Most of the time I rewatch my old favorites, this being one of them. But I love to read lots of spooky books.
Awesome. And Derek, you're the newbie to the group.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm Derek. I am the youth. I am a student at the University of Minnesota and lover of horror in all of its mediums. I'm a writer and podcaster. Regular listeners will probably not recognize me because I've never been here before, but Sherry has been on my podcast, and that's it, where we had such a good time talking about Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and 4.
Oh, yes. Nice.
That was so much fun. I'm glad that I got to reciprocate and have you on the show. So that means, Derek, that you are going to be subjected to the Scaredy Cat 5, which are five questions we ask new guests to find out about their kind of likes and passions specifically in horror. So are you ready?
I'm so ready.
Okay. What is your favorite subgenre of horror?
I think my favorite subgenre of horror is bad vibes isolation. So I mean, ooh. Texas Chainsaw is definitely kind of the impetus of that, but anything kind of like that, like I love a Hostel or a Wolf Creek or nice. Any kind of just being in a bad place where the vibes are very off and terrible things happen.
The Lodge.
What is your favorite horror movie?
My favorite horror movie is The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
How perfect. So what was the first horror movie you remember seeing?
The first horror movie I remember seeing. Well, aside from like random clips of Bride of Chucky on TV all the time when I was like four, the first horror movie I saw in full was The Descent at a sleepover.
Wow. And what do you remember what your impressions of it were? Like,
yes, I do. So The Descent is 2005, I want to say. Yeah, so I saw it in like 2007. I would have been 7 or 8.
Oh my god, and I feel so old. I realized I was in college.
I, for one, I just have to say I'm so glad that I'm finally not the young one. Like, me and Sherry hang out on Discord pretty much every night, and I'm 26, so I feel finally like one of the big kids.
My friend at the time, this kid Sean, his parents had rented it. And so it was like probably 1 a.m. when we watched it. And I just remember we were both like too scared to go back to sleep. So the only obvious choice was just to watch the movie again. And we watched it 3.5 times.
That's, oh my gosh.
I don't know if that's brave or stupid.
No, I think that's brave. When I was 7, I would, oh my gosh.
And, you know, it was a great exercise in kind of confronting your fears, because I don't want to say that the movie got less traumatic as it went on, because that would be very untrue. But it did feel like at the end of that, like by the time his parents woke up and like, you know, found us halfway through the movie for the fourth time.
Oh, my gosh.
It was like, I don't know, it was like an accomplishment or something. Like, we've braved this, and we've braved it, like, almost 4 times. So, it definitely sparked something in me that just, I wanted to see so many more movies like it. And, of course, I'd find out later that there aren't a ton of movies like The Descent, but,
no.
You know, it just kind of opened the door to horror in general.
And it does have that kind of isolation vibe, like, bad vibes, isolation yeah, theme sure. that you were talking about. It's so
claustrophobia.
So yeah, claustrophobia in that movie is too real.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Who is your ultimate final girl?
This was the question I was thinking about the most. Can I ask a question?
Of course you can.
How many times have you gotten Sydney Prescott as the answer to that?
Ooh, a lot. I would say she's probably the reigning queen so far.
Really? Yeah, I guess that's true. I always, it just surprises me because I'm always like Nancy or Laurie Strode. So it throws me when everyone's entitled to their opinion. I just always think of them as like the original or like the
I top. Think Nancy and Laurie both get a lot of responses as well, but I think Sydney wins out.
Yeah, I was wondering that. Sydney's been on my mind because me and my roommate, who also my podcast co-host, who Sherry knows, Juno, we've been watching the Scream movies this week. We watched 1 and 2 on Thursday and 3 and 4 yesterday, and we're going to go see Scream tomorrow. I've already seen it, but she has not, and I'm very excited to see it again. But so I'm actually not picking Sydney. I was just curious how, because I figured she would probably be very popular. I'm actually going to go with a little bit of an underdog final girl, and that is Alex from Alien vs. Predator.
Oh, great choice.
She has just everything that is essential to being a final girl, and her movie's really fun. So
it is really fun.
I just want to shout out, you know, Alien versus Predator for proving that, you know, the Alien movies can have great heroines that are not Ellen Ripley.
Nice. I love that.
And you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because were you aware that Texas Chainsaw Massacre inspired Ridley Scott for Alien?
You know, that makes so much sense. It really does. But I'd never heard that, like, tidbit before.
All right. How long would you last in a horror movie, Derek?
This is so hard, because I would like to believe that I survived till the end. And this is entirely based on, you know, what Scream characters I get compared to the most. And like, one time, one person on Twitter said they reminded me of Sydney Prescott, and I've kind of like turned that into a mental illness where I believe I'm the final girl. But in real life, I most often get compared to Gale, And so I kind of take that as a badge of honor and like, yeah, I could work my way through. But my secret fear is that I'm more of a Randy and that I'm gonna get pulled into a open van and, you know, stabbed a ton of times.
You have that false sense of security by surviving the first movie, but then second one, you're just gone. Mm.
But I'm definitely not as nice as Randy is. So
there you go.
Okay, well, we've been warned.
So now it's time to talk about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The letterbox summary: when Sally hears that her grandfather's grave may have been vandalized, she and her paraplegic brother, Franklin, set out with their friends to investigate. After a detour to their family's old farmhouse, they discover a group of crazed, murderous outcasts living next door. As the group is attacked one by one by the chainsaw-wielding Leatherface, who wears a mask of human skin, the survivors must do everything they can to escape. I feel like that's a little misleading because it makes you think that there are more than one survivor because the other ones don't really have a chance.
I mean, who will survive and what will be left of them, right?
Well, and like I called my parents this evening because they were dating when this movie came out. And so I had asked them, you know, like what was the hype like? Because I know there's a lot of misconceptions that it's a true story. And yes, it's loosely, so disclaimer, guys, like Texas girl telling you, there are some aspects that are loosely based on real cases like Ed Gein and, you know, like that. But I have grown up in Texas my entire life. I have never heard of a cannibalistic family out in the middle of East Texas. So just please be aware that is not true, at least to my knowledge. Now, my parents both told me that when this came out, it was hyped up like it was a 100% real story, like how the Blair Witch Project was when it came out. Mm-hmm. How, you know, they were trying to play that it, you know, this was found footage, it was real life. That's kind of how they were promoting it in the 70s when it came out. But the funny thing is, too, my mother was telling me, because she lives out in the middle of nowhere now. She lives like it is a 30-minute drive down a dirt, unmarked road through the woods to get to her house. And so a lot of the scenery here while they're driving, that's what a lot of my trip is to go see her. And she was telling me that she's got neighbors that have grown up in that area, and they will swear up and down, I remember when that happened. I know what case that really is. And she just started laughing. She goes, she's like, now there may be some aspects that are loosely based. She goes, but there are people that are just adamant. They can tell you what family it was, when it happened, who it was. She's like, but you can look in the newspapers and like do searches and see that there's nothing, especially in the time period. Because they even state it's like August, I think it's 13th. You can even look in that date through like Texas history and there's no like major cannibalistic, there's not even any major murders in that time period or in that time frame. I'm not going to say time period.
I was reminded of, for some reason, I was reminded of The Strangers when I started watching this today, because that one also does like a really clever thing where it's just like they state statistics about home invasions and then they're like, and here is our characters. And it makes it sound like these people existed, but of course,
right,
it was not a true story at all.
For sure. And like, Sherry, I know I told you a little bit about this before, but my parents made a bet whether or not to go see this movie when it came out. My father had no interest in seeing this movie. He is not a horror person at all. He didn't want to see it. And for whatever reason, because like Sherry knows and like people who've listened to this know, I will tell you, my mother does not like horror movies. Like she will not watch one unless I am with her and I can tell her when to close her eyes and when to look away. So the story is odd because she wanted to go see it. She kept telling my dad, I want to go see it. Well, my dad thought it was the safest bet. She had been making like C's and B's in calculus. So he told her, okay, you get an A on that test, I will take you to go see Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He even told me, I thought it was the safest bet. He goes, but damn it, if she didn't get an A on the next test.
She wanted to see this movie that badly. Well, like, I will spite you.
She admitted to me today, she had no real desire to go see the movie. It was more to mess with my dad. So when she got her test back and it had an A, she starts cry laughing in class. And her class and her teacher are like, oh, she's just happy to get the A. But her best friend was like, no, her boyfriend gets to go take her see Texas Chainsaw Massacre now. Well, then they go and my dad and mom are laughing because they think this movie is just so bad. My dad was like, the acting was bad. The killer was terrible. He's missing everybody by a mile. So that was always kind of the story. Well, then I asked my dad, I go, okay, well, you know, the remake came out when I was about 18. And so being the horror movie junkie I am at 18, I was like, Dad, please, will you take me and my friends to go see Texas Chainsaw Massacre at midnight? And he was telling me today, he was like, damn it all, if I didn't think in my head, took the ex-wife to see the original, now I got to go sit through the damn remake with my daughter.
That's funny. This is one of two horror movies that my mom has ever seen.
Oh, really?
Seen this and Rosemary's Baby. And I'm like, I can see why you have never seen another horror movie after seeing those.
Because how do you top that?
Ooh. Yeah. Do any of you remember the first time you saw the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
I do.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
For sure. So it was my sophomore year of college. So this would have been 2019. Yeah. I was in a class, intermediate stage direction, and I was looking for something to adapt for my final project because we all had to do these adaptations from other media. And then my sister and I were just, you know, browsing Shudder and came across Texas Chainsaw. And I wasn't even thinking about my project really when I picked it, but we were like, oh, this is a classic. We've never seen it. And we've seen like all the other, you know, we've seen Scream and Halloween and Friday the 13th. So we should definitely check this one out. And from the second it started, I was just like, no, this one's different. This one's special. Mm-hmm. And like just sat there kind of mesmerized for the whole thing. So we had already seen the remake. The remake was the first Texas Chainsaw movie I'd ever seen. But just watching this, I just was so struck, and then I ended up adapting the dinner scene and escape for my intermediate stage direction class, and it was one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. Oh. Just
an That'd instant be so cool.
love for this.
Interesting.
But yeah. So, college.
Damn. Nice. Well, I've said this on the show many times, and my story can't top that, of course, but I didn't really have a filter on what I was and was not allowed to watch growing up. It was just, I watched horror from as far back as I can possibly remember, but I think I was like, it had to have been like I was 6 or 7 years old, and we watched this as a family for some reason. And this was the first movie in memory, because I was already like super in love with a bunch by then, but this was the first movie in my memory where I was like, oh, I shouldn't be here. Like, I shouldn't this. And it fucked me up for like, I was really scared for a few days after that. So I kind of like stayed away from it for a while, but then I came back to it in my 20s and I was like, oh, this is why. And you know, I do love slashers. Like Scream is my favorite franchise ever, but the slasher subgenre has just never been my favorite. But like Derek said, this one is different. It's just so different. I know we'll talk about it, but yeah, it really sticks with you. And I think even back then when I was that young, I could just feel how like evil it is, how fucked up it is.
When I first really got into horror, because like I said, my parents don't enjoy it, so it wasn't like being raised with it. It was just more kind of a macabre interest. So like second grade, I started getting into like the universal monsters, like Frankenstein and Dracula and all that. And then when I got into like my preteens and teens, I started like really, really getting into horror, especially slashers. And so I would look up like horror movies to see before you die, cult classics. And, you know, and this one just kept popping up. And so it was kind of like a regular tradition or occurrence or routine, whatever you want to call it, on Friday nights that our dad would have us. He would pick us up. We would go to the, you know, video store
rent a movie and then go home. Well, it got to a point where like my brother and I would each pick one because I would always go into the horror section. And this one had popped up on all the lists I was looking at. So I was like, yeah, it's 70s, but okay, I'll just try it. And so I rented that and I think Halloween at the same time. And so, yeah, so watched both of those and I was like, oh, okay, we need to kind of go back and watch some of the older ones. And so, yeah, this one just became a staple where I did watch it pretty regularly. And then the only time I could ever get my friends to watch it with me is I would guilt them around my birthday.
Yeah.
So it's my birthday. I don't want to have a party. I just want you to watch these horror movies with me. And so that was always one I tortured my friends with, especially my best friend through high school and college. Like, I think she was so sick of this movie by the time we hit like 20, 21.
I also remember now I was thinking back on it and my parents too, they did the whole thing where it's like they fully bought into the fact that it was a true story. And so me being like 6 or 7 years old and being like, did this really happen? They're like, yeah, they never caught him. And I was like, oh, okay. And just
No wonder you were terrified for a few days after.
Yeah.
You never tell a kid that that person or that creature or that thing has never been caught.
I remember them specifically saying, like, yeah, that chick is probably in an institution now. And I was like, oh, okay.
I mean, listen, I don't know if you guys have seen Texas Chainsaw Next Generation, but...
Years ago.
She is.
She is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, she is.
I think it's so funny that your story about your parents seeing it in the theater... Because my mom tells me all the time she saw it at the drive-in, not in its like initial year of release, because she would have only been like 10.
Right.
But she's because they kept like releasing it every year for like 10 years mm-hmm. after that, she was able to see it when she was a teenager. And she hadn't seen it since, you know, she saw it at the drive-in. But I was talking to her about it, and I was talking about how much I liked it. Mm-hmm. And she, like, just was like that ending image, and then she went on to describe like the whole ending and like how it never left her and how, you know, viscerally it affected her. And mm-hmm. I just thought that was really interesting. Like,
I do have some interesting information when we get to that part of the discussion too. So I mean, some of what I've learned, I can understand for sure how it could leave that kind of like impression on somebody.
Directed by Tobe Hooper and written by Tobe Hooper and Kim Henkel. The two had previously worked together on Hooper's feature film debut, Eggshells. And this was kind of a very arty, psychedelic movie. I think it came out in 1969. Hooper wanted to break into Hollywood, but kind of knew that he wasn't going to be able to do so with movies like Eggshells. So he had seen graphic coverage of violence by San Antonio news outlets, and he had heard the story of Ed Gein. He mentioned that he was standing in the hardware section of a crowded store Christmas shopping, and he was like, how can I get through all these people really quickly? And
yeah,
he spotted chainsaws and thought, that's how I could get through this really quickly. And that's how he came up with the idea for Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I'm just like, you know how many serial killers probably like had that same thought?
I mean, if you've ever been Black Friday shopping, I know where he's coming from.
I used to work Black Fridays.
So I know where he's coming from.
Oh, yeah. No. I refuse to leave my house on Black Fridays now.
Working titles for the film included Saturn and Retrograde, which I actually love. I don't know that it would have attracted people as much as Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
No, and that kind of gives more of like a space alien or like mm-hmm. comet, like the Blob war kind of feel, I think.
Head Cheese was another possible title.
Blech. Gross.
I just want to say, I love Head Cheese as a title for this movie, or as a not as the actual, but as a potential title, because it's the clearest evidence to me that they were trying to make a comedy. And, like, of everything that they've said, like, you know, and Tobe Hooper on, like, the director's commentary for this mentions, he was like, we thought we were making, like, you know, a black comedy or, like, kind of a slapstick. And it's like, none of that really tracks with what's captured on screen. But when you find out that, like, one of the potential titles was Head Cheese, it all kind of makes sense.
Yeah, very true.
And then when you look at Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2,
yes, of course.
You can see the more comedic elements there.
It's like they just were like, hey, why horror? Like, let's just go this direction with it.
Yeah. It was shot by Daniel Pearl, who has worked on – he worked on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2003 remake. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, had said after making – the original, he was like, I'm never making another movie like this again, because he had a daughter. He didn't want to put that sort of thing out into the world. And then somebody reached out to him and said, hey, will you do this with me? And he was like, okay. He did Aliens versus Predator, Requiem, and Friday the 13th, the remake, and The Boy. And also lots of music videos, including the Meatloaf video, I Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That. The cast was made up of relative unknowns. These were Texans who had been in commercials, TV shows, stage shows, but hadn't really been in any kind of like big feature films. The movie filmed from July 15th, 1973 to August 14th, 1973. They originally had a 2-week shooting schedule, but filming ultimately took 4 weeks.
And man, and they were filming in Texas summer. I feel so bad for them. I was reading that summer, like, temperatures were way up in the hundreds. Like, even the dinner scene, it was 100 degrees in the Texas heat, plus the lights.
Well, plus they shot that scene for 23 straight hours.
Yeah. And I was reading, too, because I know you usually talk about box office, Sherry, but I wanted to kind of mention this because it does talk about the cast and crew's pay.
Oh, yeah.
The film's original distributor was a company called Bryanston Distribution Company, which turned out to be a mafia front operated by someone named Louis Pereno, I'm sorry if I butchered that, who used this movie to launder profits he made from Deep Throat. So, in return,
super interesting,
then the production received only enough money to reimburse the investors and to pay the cast and crew $405 apiece. That's it. When the producers eventually discovered what had happened and that they'd been lied to about the film's profits, and he was Lewis guy was arrested on obscenity charges. But once his role in Deep Throat was revealed, the cast and crew filed suit against him, and they were rewarded $25,000 each. Later on, New Line Cinema obtained the rights to the film. Because obviously Bryanston went bankrupt. They paid off the cast and crew as part of the purchase agreement.
Yeah, and apparently they even like with their, and I don't know how this really works because I'm not really savvy with this stuff, but they thought they were going to be making a certain amount of points off of the movie. Mm-hmm. And then they made points off of the points that the company was making off of the movie. So it was just all around like they got ripped off.
Very, very badly.
I do want to just point out just a little note about that little thing, because I was curious. I was like, well, how much is $405 today? And so I just looked up on the inflation calculator. And so that's about $2,200, which is, you know, not a lot of money, but it's also not nothing for being on an indie film. I'm surprised that this mafia guy even let them have that much.
That's a good point. That is a good point.
He probably didn't want them to get suspicious.
Yeah, well, and honestly, due to the budget of the film, if that had been what I was paid, I probably wouldn't have been suspicious or surprised.
Mm. Right, and that's what I was going to say. I mean, with this being like indie and no-name actors, they probably didn't know any better.
That's true. Yeah.
But I mean, I don't care then or now if that was all I got paid for 4 weeks' work. And these guys were working 7 days a week, like 16-plus hour days. I would have been like, fuck this.
Yeah.
For $405 or in today's money, $2,200, forget it.
And in the conditions, like when you look at the conditions that they shot in.
Mm-hmm.
Like I live in these conditions. No thanks.
Speaking of budget, the film's original budget was $60,000. But during the editing process, they racked up another $80,000 in costs. The producers had to sell off portions of their ownership in the film's royalties.
The accountant in me just like my stomach dropped when you said that much. It's like, oh God, more than twice the amount.
Mm-hmm. The box office. Any guesses what the box office was?
I'm not going to speak to this one because I have it in front of me.
Yeah, I also know roughly the figure, so I don't.
I have no idea. So should I?
$30.9 million. It sold over 16.5 million tickets in 1974.
That's good.
Yeah.
It was the biggest grossing independent film until
Halloween,
4 years later. So Tobe Hooper really wanted the film to receive a PG rating. He pled his case with the MPAA. He's like, the film doesn't show much gore. He's like, he said that there were probably 2 ounces of blood in the whole thing.
Yeah, this is actually one of the least bloody horror films of all time.
Daniel Pearl, the cinematographer, gave an example of someone talking to Hooper once about the movie. And the person was absolutely convinced of the gore. And Hooper was like, I don't mean to be contrary, but I know how much blood was made.
Yeah, it was something like, what, 4 ounces or something?
I think he said 2 ounces. There were about 2 ounces.
2 ounces plus the real blood that came out of Sally's finger. Yeah. Marilyn Burns' finger.
I know that we'll talk about the details of why later, of course, but the fact that he was so adamant that he had... It seems like he is much bigger on this comedic aspect of the film than what actually turned out to be. And is this 100%. Like... Is this one of the only cases you can think of where a movie just kind of like was accidentally this so scary?
No, I think I actually read, now this could be totally wrong, so if it is, don't come at me, but I think it was Last House on the Left, like Wes Craven's like first, it wasn't intended to be a horror movie at all.
Well, I think that comes across more in the actual movie.
Right.
Because that movie has all these wild... vaudeville almost bits in it.
Yeah.
Like the two bumbling cops and the chicken lady that shows up, you know, in the middle of the movie. Even like, aside from like the very graphic and harrowing assault scene that happens in the middle of that movie, a lot of that movie is kind of like, even the music, it's kind of goofy. And that's actually why I don't like that movie that much. I think tonally it's just... doesn't really land anywhere.
Now, again, I don't know if this is true, but I remember hearing or reading somewhere, it was actually, that one was actually intended to be a porn.
Well,
you know, I can see that world happening.
Yeah.
It just didn't.
It just completely took a right turn and...
Okay, so Texas Chainsaw Massacre premiered on October 1st, 1974 in Austin, Texas. It has been banned in multiple countries around the world, including Brazil, Chile, Finland, France, Iceland, Ireland, Norway, Singapore, Sweden, the then West Germany. It was banned after a one-year theatrical run in London, banned by the British Board of Film Censors. It wasn't until 1999 that the British Board of Film Censors allowed it to be released with an 18-plus certificate. Which means you had to be 18 or older to see it.
So, like, basically an R?
Or almost like an NC-17.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, because I think 18 plus means they don't let anyone under 18 in?
Right.
Yeah.
Two theaters in Ottawa, Ontario, were advised by police to pull the film or they would face morality charges.
Morality charges. Jesus.
But reviews were pretty good. So Roger Ebert, who hated horror movies, actually enjoyed it and said it was as violent and gruesome and blood-soaked as the title promises. It's not blood-soaked.
But it's not.
No, I mean, but it feels blood-soaked,
it
doesn't
it?
It does, like,
it, yeah. 100%.
Every time I show this movie to someone, like the across the board, the response is almost word for word always, I want to take a shower. Yeah. Like.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, it's a pretty gross and dirty movie, but...
I mean, it isn't bloody, and it's, you know, empirically, there's just no evidence to support that, but I also, like, I do get it, because it feels so much more, like, graphically violent than it is. It's violent, but it's not graphically violent.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's almost to a point... a little bit more realistic, and that's why it bothers more people. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I could be wrong. But, like, even with the title, The Chainsaw Massacre, who really, how many people really get killed by this chainsaw?
One.
Yeah, the only person that we see get cut by it is him.
Yeah. The you see Franklin get attacked with the chainsaw.
You technically do not see it cut him. You see...
No, but he's the only one that dies by a chainsaw.
Right, right.
In fact, there are more instances of somebody jumping out a window than there are people being attacked by a chainsaw. Variety also referenced the movie's heavy doses of gore. Donald B. Berrigan of the Cincinnati Inquirer said, Marilyn Burns as Sally deserves a special Academy Award for one of the most sustained and believable acting achievements in movie history.
That I agree with.
100%. No, you don't agree with that?
I'm going to get on my acting soapbox here for a second.
Oh, God.
If you guys don't mind. So when we covered this movie on my own podcast, like 2 years ago at this point, I had my friend Scott, who is an amazing actor, one of the best I know, and we've done shows together and stuff. We talked about the amazing performances from every single person in this movie because of the many styles of acting that there are, and there are too many, actually, frankly, in my opinion. The hardest by far is naturalism. Mm-hmm. And that is like this movie, Paranormal Activity, Blair Witch, found footage of every type, all employ the use of naturalistic acting. And it's really fucking hard. And I actually think most found footage movies don't get the level of performances that we get from this movie. I think it's really obvious in the scenes when the teens are all together and they're just kind of talking about shit. Mm-hmm. But then it also comes through in the scenes where people are scared. You know, when like everyone has such a different reaction to fear and how they employ that. But we also have to remember that, like, due to the nature of the set, like, not all of it is acting. Some of it's, like, is just real. And I think it's easy enough to not see the difference between what is real and what is acting. That's why I've always considered the acting in this movie really good.
Okay, I can kind of see that. And since you mentioned, like, the naturalism and the acting versus not acting, I did want to, like, kind of let you guys know, too, that the gentleman that played Franklin, he would stay in character to the point that the gentleman that played Leatherface was so annoyed by him for constantly complaining that when he got to his death scene, he was excited to get rid of him. And the bickering between Sally and Franklin is real because the two actors did not like each other.
Yeah. In addition to, I was also thinking along the lines of like, well, yeah, it seems like a lot of this isn't really acting because they were so fucking hot and tired. I was watching it tonight, there was a moment that I just never really clocked before, but I did tonight, where I think the character's name is Jerry. Was that Sally's boyfriend?
Yeah.
When he confronts Leatherface for the first time, it's super realistic because it's this moment where he is like freaked out by what he's seeing in the freezer, and then he turns around and sees Leatherface, and he just has this jump, and he screams like high-pitched terror. And I was like, I've never, like, you wouldn't expect a director to tell this man, like, hey, I want you to scream like really shrill.
And something about that too was that the gentleman that played Leatherface, he kept his distance from all of them. Like, a lot of them kind of stayed in character. Like, the actors would refer to each other by their character names. So he would keep his distance. So a lot of their reactions, like their most genuine, like what you're talking about, is the first time that they encountered him.
Yeah, I can't even imagine.
So with Jerry, that was his genuine first time reaction to seeing that guy. And the guy is like 6'4", and then they had him in like 3-inch heel shoes when he was in costume too. So you've got this towering man you've not seen. He's got that funky mascot. I mean, like, grown man or not, I mean, I think anybody would scream that high pitched if you saw that just coming at you from around the corner.
Oh, for sure. So two of my personal favorite horror creators have also commented on the movie. Wes Craven said about his first viewing of the movie, what kind of Mansonite crazoid could have created such a thing? And supposedly made The Hills Have Eyes as an homage to the movie.
Does it come from the guy who came up with Freddy Krueger?
Well, yeah, but that wouldn't be for another, 10 years?
True.
Stephen King said, I would happily testify to its redeeming social merit in any court of the country.
Mm. Love you, King.
Like that. Thanks for being a guy, Mr. King.
Okay, well, just randomly, Guillermo del Toro, is that his name?
Guillermo del Toro, yeah.
Yeah, this movie made him a vegetarian.
Yes, it did.
I think this movie made a lot of people vegetarians. Yeah.
Well, I figure since we're talking about filmmakers' reactions, you know, that fit.
Yeah. And also, Bong Joon-ho referenced it when he won his Oscar.
Oh, well, there we go.
Really?
In his speech, yeah.
I did not know that. So clearly a very influential movie.
I love we've been talking about this for like 45 minutes and we've not even started like the actual movie yet.
I know, my very next note is about the movies.
Wait,
about starting the
before we do, Ari Aster referenced it in Midsommar. Okay, now you can start.
Okay, rewind. Remind me, when did he reference it in Midsommar?
When Josh, which one is the one who's doing his thesis?
Yeah.
But there's two of them that are supposedly doing their thesis.
You're talking about the guy from
William Jackson Harper. Yes.
Yeah.
When he sneaks into the one building where they keep all their ledgers and stuff, the sledgehammer part, and then the mask where he's wearing someone else's face.
Okay. All right. Okay. Silly me. I never made that connection, and I love Midsommar. That's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
Thank you for reminding me. I appreciate it. Oh, real quick, one last little thing, and then we can get started, Sherry. Sorry, I just saw this in my notes. The guy who played the hitchhiker, Edwin Neal, he claims that the Texas State Troopers actually shook his hand and thanked him for causing crime to drop 18% after this movie was released.
Because nobody wanted to pick up hitchhikers.
Yeah, apparently the message audiences took away was don't pick up hitchhikers.
It's a good lesson to learn.
I just thought it was funny the state troopers would go and thank him for that.
So we open with a voiceover done by Night Court's John Larroquette. If you're younger than
me,
if you're young, you probably don't know what Night Court is. But anyways, it was the show that I used to go home and watch on my lunch hour in high school. So
do you know what his payment for doing the opening narration was?
Marijuana.
A marijuana joint. Not even like a lot, just a joint. That was his payment.
There's this scrolling text. It sets up the film as a true account of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of history. It is August 18th, 1973, and over a black screen, we hear the sound of digging before we get this whir and flash of a camera that shows close-ups of decaying hands and other body parts. There's like close-ups of teeth with the gums receded. It's nasty.
And that sound of the camera doing the photos, like that gives me chills like to this day.
We then hear a radio broadcast and we get a full on close up of a goopy looking decomposing head. We learn that the top story of the day in this small town is grave robbing. There's been a corpse staged on a monument in the cemetery, and right away you're uncomfortable. You get that glaring sun, you get this dust blowing in the wind, and shots of these decomposing body parts.
I just want to say that is one of my favorite opening shots in, I know it's not technically the opening shot, but like, you know, in movie history, it's so unsettling. Mm. And that was the moment when I saw the corpse and the way it looked and everything. I was like, oh, this is different, isn't it? Like this is kind of its own thing.
The opening credits roll and we continue to hear these radio reports, but we've moved from the graveyard and we're seeing red and black images of solar flares.
Which kind of throws back to foreshadows the retrograde, because Pam does talk about it quite a bit later on in the vehicle too.
So I want to talk a little bit about the sound design of the movie, because there isn't a traditional soundtrack or score.
No, and I love it. I think it makes it 10 times more creepy that it's no actual like music. It's like animal sound, like basically I think I read somewhere it was akin to the sounds that an animal would hear in a slaughterhouse.
I absolutely love that little fact about this movie so much. I think that's one of the things that sets it apart. And also I noticed watching tonight, a lot of the kill scenes, there is a live animal somewhere in the set, in the scene, like the chicken in the cage or just a pig squealing somewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's like noises of the animal on top of the industrial machinery sound with the visual of a person getting, you know, like sledgehammered the way an animal in a slaughterhouse would.
Well, I mean, they treat these people like they're animals in the slaughterhouse. I mean, you've got the meat hook, you've got the freezers, you've got the sledgehammer. Spoilers.
It's just incredible. Like, from just artistically, and me and you talk about this so much, Sherry, we always go back to the elementals. that amazing Michael McDowell book where it takes place in the southern heat, and it's written so beautifully that you can feel that oppressive heat. And it's like from frame one of this movie, it's the same thing. You feel that like dirty Texas heat. No offense.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. It is not dirty. These people are a little dirty. I'm not going to lie. I watched
it. It's dirty. Like there's the dust and...
Now, okay, am I the only one that like as you're watching this movie, you can kind of smell these people?
Oh, yeah.
Like with the sweat mm-hmm. and the musk and the... Okay, so it's not just me. But no, I mean, I get it. Texas heat sucks. And especially in certain areas because it's a dry heat on top of it. It sucks. But at the same time, when you grow up with it, you're just kind of like, well, damn, it's another... Another day. Thank God for AC. All I gotta say.
The interesting thing that I found out was most of the animal sounds that you hear. So not the chicken so much because we actually see the chicken, but when you hear like pigs squealing, those were actually done by the father of crew member Wayne Bell.
Really?
Yeah, who did the sound production with Toby Hooper, and he was also like the boom man.
I'm imagining that conversation, though, where he's like, guys, we don't have the budget for these farm animals. And then some guy in the back is like, my dad can do it. My dad can do it for you real good.
By the time we see the face-up dead armadillo on the road, we are already on edge.
Well, some are. Sorry, I just mean it's like a natural occurrence here.
Oh, no, I don't mean that just the dead armadillo actually makes you, like, everything that's building up so far makes you, like, on edge. Art director Robert Burns actually learned how to taxidermy that armadillo for the movie.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
They originally were going to have a dead dog
in the shot.
But they decided not to do that. They then saw a dead horse in the road and thought, we could do that.
Like a real dead horse?
Yeah, like a real dead horse.
You'd be surprised at what you see on the roads here.
Oh, I'm not surprised about the dead horse being there. I was just kind of, well, I guess there was a low budget movie.
The problem was nobody wanted to go close enough to the dead horse because it smelled really badly.
Yeah.
So they decided to go a little smaller and did the dead armadillo. Robert Burns was very adamant with Toby Hooper and said, do not run over my taxidermied armadillo with that van. Because he was very proud of his work on the armadillo.
And frankly, he should be. I mean, no, you know, that's the taxidermy work, I'm sure, was fine. But I just mean the inclusion of the armadillo. It's kind of iconic.
It is.
Well, I would think after all that work into it, if it's, especially when you learn to do it for that reason, you would be livid for someone to just run over it like it was nothing at that point. Yeah,
absolutely.
So this green van pulls up on the side of the road and we meet this gang of travelers. So we have Sally and Franklin Hardesty, who are played by Marilyn Burns and Paul Partain. Kirk, who is played by William Vale. Pam, played by Terry McMinn. And Jerry, played by Alan Danziger. They've pulled over. So Franklin, as I mentioned, is paraplegic. They pulled over so that he can pee in a coffee can. But unfortunately for him, a truck comes speeding by. He gets knocked down the hill. So my opinion on Franklin has changed a lot over repeated viewings.
He's a brat.
He is a bit of a brat, but I kind of get where he's coming from as I've watched the movie more. Okay, yeah. What are your takes on Franklin?
I mean, okay, I do think he's a brat. I do understand his frustration and it is justified, but I don't like the grown man constantly complaining. And then like when they're up in the family house and he's down on the ground floor and he's like, like whatever you want to, I don't even know what you would call that sound. But yeah, just doing that. I'm like, really, how old are you?
Well, that's a good question. How old are they?
Do you think so I had a thought. Do you think he is the younger brother or the older brother?
Younger, absolutely.
That's kind of what I thought too. I was just curious if anyone thought otherwise.
I actually don't really have an opinion on Franklin because it always, whenever I think of Franklin and his scenes where he's a little bit much. I always think back to the whole comedic debate because part of me is like, am I the viewer supposed to think this is funny? Because I don't, not for one second. It's another thing that adds to like the uncomfortableness of, because you can feel that he's grating on everyone around them. And I think that adds to it.
Yeah. And I get it. Like when we watch it and I understand that he is grating to the audience and to the other characters, but they treat him pretty terribly.
They treat him so badly. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, I don't understand the whole just leaving him outside on his own. And even later, then my other thing is too, like, as annoying as I do find him, at the same time, he's the only one who's really taking note of how creepy and odd a lot of what is going on.
He's like the, you know, the guy in, you know, every movie. That, like, you know, the guy in stereotypical every movie that's like, something's not right, you know.
Yeah.
It's not enough to save him, you know, unfortunately. And part of that, I think, maybe comes from being disabled and needing to have a greater awareness of the world around him.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
That's literally just something I pulled out of my ass, but it is
I like
a possible reading of the character, you know.
Because, like, I know my personality enough to where if we did pick up a hitchhiker and we had that interaction, I would be the one the entire time, like, can we just not go home? Because, like, this is really unsettling. He's marked the car. Are you sure he's not going to just pop up? I mean, he can't find us, right? Like, that would be me. I would be freaked out and constantly, like, questioning that. So I do understand to a point of him wanting to, like, get the hell out of Dodge.
So once they're back in the van, Pam, as we mentioned, she's talking about astrology. She's like, Saturn's a bad influence. It's a particularly bad influence right now because it's in retrograde, hence the Saturn in retrograde working title. And they pull up to this cemetery, and this cemetery is positively teeming with folks. Like, this is the happening thing on this day. Sally has heard about the grave robbing. She wants to check on her grandfather's grave. We have this drunk guy. I reference him as Crazy Ralph, even though that's Friday the 13th, which came years later.
Yeah, it's the same guy. He just moved to Crystal Lake after this.
Exactly. He says, things happen around here that people don't talk about. He sees things. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a throwaway line, so it doesn't seem particularly ominous. But he even says, no one listens to the old man.
Mm. Pay attention to the old man, people. Seriously.
Franklin, however, is listening to him, and he's getting a little uncomfortable. He's moving further back into the van. But once they've confirmed that grandfather's grave is undisturbed, they get back into the van. And they're going to all head to the Hardesty ancestral home. So they pass by a slaughterhouse, which they smell before they see it.
Oh, yeah.
Derek, you used the word visceral earlier, like, to describe, like, your reaction in this movie. And that's exactly, like, this whole section, the whole movie, really. But it's so visceral. You could smell the odors. You could feel the heat. And Franklin goes off on how they would kill the cattle at the slaughterhouse. He's like, they would hit them with a sledgehammer. Sometimes they'd have to do it more than one time.
Like, dude, read a room. Nobody wants to hear that.
Foreshadowing. Pam is appalled, and even Sally's like, you know what? I don't want to hear about it. Like, I like meat, so don't tell me these things. And Franklin tries to reassure her by telling her they do it differently now. They use a big air gun that kills them instantly.
Still don't want to know about it.
This is when they spot the hitchhiker, and there's a bit of debate about picking him up, but they ultimately decide to do so. Franklin says, we just picked up Dracula.
Yeah,
let's just say that to the guy.
More like Renfield.
As, you know, he's in the car.
More like Renfield.
Well, yeah. Franklin pays the price. Remember, he's the one that gets cut.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yep.
And this hitchhiker is definitely a little off. He tells them he was hanging out at the slaughterhouse, you know, as you do.
I mean, that's what I do in my spare time.
Yeah, all the kids go down to hang out at the slaughterhouse.
Oh, yeah, we want to see that air gun.
His family works there, he says, his brother and his grandfather. And Franklin nails it again when he says, oh, a whole family of Draculas. Why did they let him in the vehicle? That's all that I have to ask. Why? Why did they let him in the vehicle?
Well, it was so hot. They said it was so hot outside that he would suffocate out there.
But
this is still even a thing. Like, because I'll watch, like, a documentary about the Texas killing fields. And I live, like, right off that main highway where a lot of that happened. And my parents, I'll call them and start yelling at them, like, why were you hitchhiking back then? Mm. I was like, I get that at the time that's what they did, but no. Like, that's why so much happened.
You still have to have a litmus test about what kind of hitchhiker you're picking up. Like, this guy does not look normal in any way. And, like, and he does not act normal.
I don't care. You could look like St. Betty White on the side of the road. I'm still not stopping for you.
I would stop for Betty White, 100%. Franklin now has somebody to talk to about slaughtering cows, though, and this hitchhiker has some very strong opinions about the sledgehammer's supremacy over the air gun. And he mentions that the air gun took away jobs before showing some grisly Polaroids he took of some slaughtered cows.
he seems to really like Franklin.
He does. They've made a bit of a connection, but everyone else is just grossed out.
When I did my little project, I made a PowerPoint that's really just an essay in PowerPoint format, except not even really in PowerPoint format. It's just kind of long blocks of text. That's not important, but this was one of the first times I noticed the very timely thematic nature of the movie, because, you know, 74, so obviously it's all about, you know, end of Vietnam anxieties and stuff like that. But I think this is also one of the first times that we can mark the Texas Chainsaw Massacre as what I call the quintessential American fairy tale. I think this first interaction with the hitchhiker is the first that kind of thematically links it to that idea, in that, like, you know, we meet the villain and their motive, if you want to frame it that way, is, you know, kind of the myth of the American economic anxiety. Not the myth, but like the way that we often talk about poor people in this, you know, in this country. And just, you know, the idea that, like, that poor Americans are constantly turning evil or, like, something because of the lack of jobs and other, again, like, financial and economic anxieties is interesting. And I actually think the movie is kind of aware of how weird that is because of how far they take the Sawyers' brutality and the fact that they make them cannibals in the first place. Yeah, it's more... There's a cleaner, more academically satisfying way to talk
about this. You're doing good.
That was interesting.
I read something about the meaning of the name Sawyer. I'm trying to find...
Well, we should mention that I don't think they're called the Sawyers until 2.
But they're even still, right. Even in the trivia, though, they're still referred to as the Sawyer family anyway. But... This says here, a Sawyer is a person who uses a chainsaw. Some sources have also noted it resembles to Sawnee, as in the cannibal clan led by Sawnee Bean in medieval Scotland.
Yeah, like the idea of American anxiety coming through in this movie. Like there was, you mentioned Vietnam, Watergate. This was like right at the height of the Watergate scandal.
Oh, yeah.
There was... issues with like getting gas, which we actually see. There's like a little hint of that in the movie. So the early 70s were really, really tumultuous. And, you know, you had cults springing up
The Manson
family like 4 years before. So there was a lot of that. And I think the thing that I read that really stuck out for me was somebody said that the Sawyers were victims of industrial capitalism. And I'm like, yeah, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
And I actually, watching it this time, I started thinking, I'm like, are they actually the victims in this? Because these people are going to their homes. They're invading their homes.
I told you, you don't just enter a Texan's home, dude. Like, you're asking for what's going to happen.
You could see it as a home invasion movie.
Yes.
It is. I mean, it completely is, especially from Leatherface's point of view. I mean, think of how distressed he gets when these teenagers keep entering his homes. Granted, I don't think it's as simple as saying the Sawyers are the victims.
And, yeah, no, for sure.
But I do think that it adds a layer of complexity to the conversation, at least, around the movie. Because... I mean, they have been victimized by other people, by systems, but that does not mean that they are also not the victimizers in terms of, like, this group of teens.
And Gunnar Hansen does a really good job of non-verbally conveying, like, being startled and, like, distressed that all these people are coming into his house. And then, of course, because, you know, they're not just victims, it turns into this thing. Well, it's like, well, don't let them get away.
Yeah, I mean, he does really well expressing that kind of stuff. I mean, because there were some lines of, like, written gibberish in the script for the character. And Toby Hooper would sit with Gunnar Hansen and tell him what the lines meant, but it was still up to Gunnar to figure out a way to express that, to really convey what he was feeling or going through or experiencing in that moment.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys have ever like seen the actual script, but it's kind of crazy. Not only in like the subtle differences, of course, in some of the lines and stuff, because I think they use the script as a loose suggestion of what was gonna what was gonna end up on screen. But like when the Leatherface stuff comes in, it really is kind of just keyboard smashing.
Yeah, and I mean a lot of it, they let him, Gunnar Hansen, just kind of figure it out on his own. I read somewhere too, trying to find my notes on it. Gunnar was allowed to develop Leatherface as he saw fit under Hooper's supervision. So Gunnar decided that Leatherface was mentally handicapped and never learned to talk properly. So to prepare, he went to a school for the mentally handicapped and watched how they moved and listened to how they spoke in order to get a feel for the character. And he tried his best to make this portrayal as non-offensive as he could.
I think then there's almost this mirroring, perhaps, between Leatherface and Franklin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're both kind of the kicked puppy of their respective family and friend.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're both, like, in this reading, they're both disabled and, like, not, that's not really ever taken into account by the people around them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, Franklin's friends are often physically aware that he is disabled, for instance, helping him out of the car and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like they're mentally aware of it.
Yeah.
So, like, some of the hardships that come with that really do seem to be, like, and it is a little, I guess, inconveniencing, but they really seem to be, like, taking it personally.
Yeah.
And I think the family treats Leatherface the same way.
Yeah, like it's more, with Franklin at least, it comes across more like it's all an inconvenience for them.
Interesting.
It's funny, I have a little bit of a case for like mirroring Franklin with Nubbins, who is actually a hitchhiker.
Oh.
But I'll get into that later.
Oh, that too, but I think Nubbins is a little bit like mentally handicapped too, just on a different way.
Well, I think later on in the franchise, they talk about how the family was inbred, so...
Yeah. Now, for everyone, that's not a common occurrence in Texas. I'm just going to say, don't judge us.
I don't think cannibalism is either, so I think you're okay.
Not in my area, anyway.
So at this point, the hitchhiker takes Franklin's switchblade out of his hand before using it to slice his palm open. And they all look apprehensive, but the hitchhiker is oblivious. He's just showing off his own knife. He's like, it's a good knife, as Kirk tries to placate him. Now, obviously, when in a situation such as this, you want a souvenir. So the hitchhiker takes out a Polaroid camera and snaps a photo of the group.
I don't think it's that he wanted a souvenir. He wanted money.
I know. I'm being sarcastic. So when they refuse to buy the photo, he invites them for dinner at his house. He's like, no, you can drop me off at my house. You can come for dinner. We'll have head cheese. It'll be delicious.
You like head cheese.
He does not take them saying, no, we'll drop you off here very well. And he sets the photo on fire using some tinfoil and what I'm assuming is gunpowder. He then gets really riled up and he grabs Franklin's arm and cuts him. So there is absolute pandemonium in the van. Everyone is freaking out before they kick him out.
But why did it have to go to that extent before they just got this guy out of the car anyway?
Well, it feels like there's almost this fear-induced paralysis that takes over the group. I mean, except for Jerry, who seems to be the one who's like, what is happening? Because he's driving.
Yeah.
And he's like, what's going on? Like, what the hell? And he can't really do anything because, I mean, he could stop the car. But, you know, he can't throw the hitchhiker out because he's driving. And so apart from him, everyone else seems to be like in shock a little bit over what the behavior that they're witnessing.
But do you think that would have been his reaction had they not rejected his dinner invitation?
50-50. I mean, like, it's so unpredictable, right?
Because he looked like very disappointed that they were like, oh, well, we're in a hurry. Not saying I would go have dinner with the guy, but like, just.
Or, you know, perhaps you're right. Perhaps he would have kept up the pretense, like almost in a House of a Thousand Corpses manner where he brings them back.
Yeah, exactly. Then, like he was the lure.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
And then when he didn't get that opportunity, he was quick to mark the car.
Yeah. He runs along the van for a few seconds. He's kicking the side. As you say, Ryan, he marks the car. He smears blood on it. And Kirk at this point says he's half ready to call the cops. Half ready? You're half ready to call the cops?
Okay. And the other thing is, too, this is the 70s. So you're going to have to, like, go find a phone to begin with.
That's also true. That's a good point.
You know, if this happened today, that there would be a camera phone out and, you know, we got you. End up on TikTok or...
Franklin and Sally have their horoscopes read by Pam, and Franklin's horoscope promises a disturbing and unpredictable day, while Sally says, there are moments when we cannot believe that what is happening is actually true. Pinch yourself and you may find out that it is.
Foreshadow.
Not good. So they should just turn around. Turn around now. Don't even bother going to their grandparents' house.
Yeah, they already checked the grave, so like, just go home.
And I, you know what? I wish they didn't go to their grandparents' house. But we'll get more into that later.
So it's time to stop for gas, but there's no gas, as I mentioned earlier. So instead we get this little chat with the guy played by Jim Seidow, who is working at the gas station. And he seems very nice. He's a little concerned about them going to the old Franklin house. He's like, you could get hurt, you know.
Yeah, that's the concern.
Franklin now is stabbing the inside of the van with his knife. So when I mentioned earlier that there's this kind of like mirroring, maybe it's not even mirroring, it's like this transference, like, because he's now been cut with the knife that the hitchhiker used to cut himself. Mm-hmm. So he's got the hitchhiker's blood flowing through his veins. Is he now possessed with the spirit of Franklin? Not Franklin, of Nubbins.
He's possessed by himself.
It just seems weird because he starts to act a little out of character at this point. And he's the only one that eats the barbecue that Jerry comes back to the van with.
Which, gross, yeah. Don't do that.
Oh my God, the piece of barbecue he puts in his mouth looks like a dick.
I don't know if you guys know this, but Sherry, I was sending you a bunch of stuff about this. That gas station and the house are both very well known here in Texas, but that gas station... it's up and running, and it's a small little motel, and they sell beef and pork barbecue.
I don't know that I would eat there. I would go.
I so want to go. It's in Bastrop, Texas. They've got like I think I read it was 4 rooms that they had built onto it. And then there's like the van outside, and they've got, you know, some of the movie memorabilia and stuff like that. So Sherry, you come down to Texas. That's 2 of the stops right there, is the house and the gas station.
All right, deal. At this point, Sally notices that the van has been marked with blood, like he was trying to write something. But they kind of dismiss it. They don't really take it too seriously. And they finally arrive at the family home, which is just a tad run down.
Like, how long ago did this grandfather die? And if the father owns this property, why is no one taking care of it? This looks like an abandoned house.
I guess maybe just the land. They just want the land. I don't know.
Yeah, I always skip this scene because of there's a shot. There's a shot with the spiders, and I'm so phobic of insects. And I just every time that's like the biggest jump scare in the whole movie for me. Every time I see it, it just so I skip that scene. But I remember it very vividly because we get a lot of Franklin showing his ass in a way. Yeah. But also, like, yeah, I get it. I'd be upset too, but.
Well, especially when you hear them all cutting up and laughing upstairs and, like, no regard for him at all, which, if you didn't want him to come, then why invite him?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it also, it's a little bit like he's trapped on the, you know, he's alone on the ground floor of this disgusting house. There's bugs everywhere. He's eating, some pork that looks exactly like a penis. Like,. He truly, I mean, listen, we all love some good dick-shaped foods, but like, I would prefer it to not be actual meat, you know?
Well, and my thing is too, you figure that it's hot in the house because there's no AC. He already looks like he's drenched in sweat. He's been cut, so I'm sure he's uncomfortable. He's already had kind of a shit day. Then he's going to eat this probably not very good barbecue that is probably hot on top of it.
I keep saying it looks like a penis. Given what we know, like...
It probably is a penis.
It probably just is.
And then he sees that pile of bones and feathers and, like, these dangling assortment of bones. Like, somebody has hung these bones up.
Exactly. Like,
Does it just feel like all this stuff is like someone's like art? Like it's Nubbin's art that he's leaving all over the place?
For sure. No.
So here's my next question. Yeah. They obviously live close to Leatherface and his family.
Well,
because
close in terms of where they are geographically, sure.
Yes. So my question is, how do Franklin and Sally not remember the Sawyer family who lived down the road a little bit? Because they basically, when they're walking to the water hole, the swimming hole, as they call it, that's how they kind of get on the path of going to the Sawyer house. So like,
the only thing I can figure is maybe they were keeping a low profile and weren't on the family's radar, or the two when they were kids weren't there enough to really register it.
That's what I think it was. Mm.
And really, too, I mean, if Franklin is still thinking that there's a watering hole there or a creek or whatever, they even say, well, the last time he had to have been there was when someone could have carried him.
Mm.
Right. So it all kind of, I don't know, it just feels like it's an open secret in the town a little bit, but are they really, you know, from the town enough to be privy to it?
It's probably more of those instances where if you're out and about and you happen to see one of the Sawyers, you kind of hold your kids a little bit closer and you just tell them, like, don't interact with them.
But wouldn't you think there'd still be, like, rumors about that? And, like, okay, so their grandfather would have worked at, oh, sorry, their grandfather took cattle to that slaughterhouse that Grandfather Sawyer worked at, as well as one of the brothers. So, like, I don't know. It just feels weird to me that, like, they don't know anything about this. But you're right. They haven't been there in years.
Yeah, and I mean, really, it's your grandparents. It's not quite the same as, like, your parents who you're with every day. Some people don't see their grandparents but maybe once or twice a year in some instances. Especially if, like, they live out in a country area like that. You're not around them that much to really know the town secrets. Like, you're a visitor. You're an outsider as far as they're concerned anyway. And in all honesty, too, if there were any suspicions about the Sawyer family, I'm sure the grandparents probably made sure to keep, like, a really close eye on the two of them when they were younger and they were visiting.
So Pam and Kirk decide to go swimming at the old swimming hole, and they're positively gleeful as they run through the woods.
Which, I wouldn't be swimming in a creek out there anyway, because it's probably got snakes and all sorts of other things in there.
Oof.
That is my rule. I do not swim in, like, creeks or anything like that, because if it's too murky and I can't see what's in there, I'm going to assume there's a snake or something in there, and I'm just not going to tempt fate.
Well, luckily the water hole looks like it's pretty much dried up. So
yeah, which,
well, and maybe not luckily, I should say.
Well, and that does happen. Like, my family's got some property that's kind of out in the country out towards San Antonio, and there's a pond out there, and there are certain times or certain years where that sucker is pretty much dried up. So that's kind of common down here in Texas, too.
So they hear a generator in the distance. And remember, they couldn't get gas earlier because the gas station was out of gas. So they decide to go check it out. And they end up at a farmhouse. And there are some things about this farmhouse that should be setting off alarms in their heads.
I'm sorry, that, like, collection of cars?
Hidden.
Bye.
Undernetting. Yes.
Bye.
It's a really cool shot, though.
It's a cool shot, but if you're, like, stumbling upon that in real life, are you going to go explore and keep walking in?
The thing that I always go back to about this movie is that, like, my memories of seeing it as a kid, I always thought, and it's because of how atmospheric it is, I always thought it was, like, a dirty-looking movie and, like, hard to see and super grainy and everything. And one of the big things that I realized when I came back to it as an adult was, like, there's some really nice shots in this film, and it looks
beautiful
sometimes.
Oh, there's that scene where they're walking through the field and you see the sunflowers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like,
I mean, it looks, at some points it almost doesn't even look like it's from the 70s. Like, just when we get especially still shots of objects, it just, I don't, it becomes so clear at some points. It's just like, oh, is this, you know. But then, of course, you're dragged back and you see a character and you're like, oh, no, this is 70s. Look at how they're dressed. Like,
and just because of how violent and, like, grungy the movie is and the events that happen in it, it's almost like you remember it as being far, like, filmier, like, literally, like, a filmy lens, grimier than
it
really is.
In the same way, like, you remember it being gory.
Yeah, exactly.
So not only are these cars hidden away, there's, like, dangling tree decor. They find a decayed tooth on the porch.
See, that for me is truly, that's the absolute farthest I'm pushing it. Like, once we find a tooth, I'm sorry, other hot guy in the cast, but like, not coming inside.
My boyfriend tosses a tooth that he found at me. He's walking home. I'm taking the car.
So Kirk knocks on the door. There's no answer. So, okay, so move along. But no.
Oh, no. He's ready to go. No, he's going to just welcome himself inside.
He sticks his head in the door. He calls out. And looking at that front hallway, there are animal skins. There are skulls literally everywhere. And there's that red room at the end of the hallway.
All those animal, like, corpses and bones that you see kind of all throughout the house. Those were borrowed from a local veterinarian. This is so terrible. Towards the end of production, the question of how to get rid of the corpses came up. So Hooper remembers, now he doesn't say this was him, but who knows, someone piling them behind the house and setting them on fire. But no, like you were saying, though, if I look down the hall into this house and all I see is a red, like red room anyway. Granted, yes, my bedroom was red in high school, but I still would be going in the house.
Yeah, when there's animal skins and furs and animal skulls decorating the walls. No, no, you don't go in. But Kirk may be handsome, but he's not particularly savvy. So he runs towards the red room at the end of the hall, where he pretty much runs right into Leatherface. who whacks him with a sledgehammer.
And he starts seizing.
Yeah, his death is brutal.
But that's how they were describing how it would happen sometimes with animals, is that they would start seizing.
I want to talk a little bit about Leatherface because he has three distinct masks in the movie. So he's got his old lady mask.
The reason he wore a mask was to help determine his personality. So I'm sorry, Sherry. I didn't mean to just completely cut you off. I was just excited because I've been waiting to talk about this.
That's okay.
So there's three different masks. There's the killing mask, the old lady mask, and the pretty woman mask. When he's wearing the old lady mask, he's wearing an apron and carrying a wooden spoon. So in that instance, he wants to be domestic. He wants to be helpful in the kitchen. Later on at the dinner scene, he wears a different face, which is the pretty woman, which has makeup. So along with that mask, the outfit consists of a female wig and a black suit as he is dressing up for dinner, which is, you know, a Deep South tradition, which you could say comes from his Southern upbringing, but, you know, hey. And then the killing mask is the skin mask he wears while chasing and murdering captives. Hansen later added in an interview, the idea of the mask is that there is no personality under the mask. That was the idea in talking with Toby and Kim. When they created the character, they said he was to put on masks to express himself because he himself can't do it. The way he tried to create him, there is nothing under the mask, which is what makes him so frightening.
You know what's interesting? I mean, all of that is very interesting. I didn't mean to make it seem like it wasn't.
You're just bored of me. I can tell. I'm
just gonna say it like, I don't know if you guys have seen Rob Zombie's Halloween remake, but particularly in the first one, there's an element of that too.
Absolutely.
It's actually like a big theme, especially in the first half of the movie, before he escapes.
Yeah, because his room in the asylum's like covered in masks.
Yeah, and I just think it's interesting because, you know, Michael Myers in the 1978 Halloween is almost the antithesis of that, where, like, there's no personality beneath the mask, sure, but there's also no personality with the mask.
Right.
Like, they're serving different so that was just an interesting thing to me. And, you know, clearly Rob Zombie is very inspired by the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and all of his works.
Right. And I think they've said similar things about, like, with Jason Voorhees and the hockey mask because it's expressionless.
Yeah.
There's no personality. There's no expression. It's just basically nothing coming at you, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
But I also think it makes characters like Leatherface more interesting as characters because they're not just, like, you know, a walking theme hunting down characters, which is well and good and also has its place and has produced a lot of great writing and great movies. Like, I, mm-hmm. you know, love Michael and love Jason. But I think it makes Leatherface feel like a character in his own movie as opposed to just, like, either just a plot device or even a set piece sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense, and I'm really not trying to come harsh on the other slashers. Again, no, they're great. I covered all 12 Friday movies on the channel, and it was so much fun, but it's just Leatherface feels, and granted, this is because, you know, he's before that kind of slasher.
Yeah.
But he feels more like a character, you know, a little kid, sure, but, you know, mm-hmm. still a character.
Totally, mm-hmm. totally agree.
It's interesting that even if you look at his evolution into Texas Chainsaw 2, he only wears one mask during that movie.
That's right.
But he has more of a facial personality. Like, his face is doing, his actual face is doing more mm-hmm. personality mm-hmm. work. Because, like, the idea, right, is that, like, he's like a toddler almost mm-hmm. in, or like a young child in the first one. And then in the second one, he's now a teenager. So he's
matured a little
for whatnot, yeah. going through puberty.
Yeah.
By this point, Pam, who's been sitting on a swing outside, she becomes a little concerned. She starts calling out for Kirk as she approaches the house. And that shot from under the swing as she approaches the house, and the house just looms so large, because the house is really kind of a character of its own.
Oh yeah. This got Toby in trouble because he fought so hard to keep that shot in.
I heard that, yeah.
Like, producers and whatnot, they were threatening to cut him off of the movie if he continued fighting for that shot.
Yeah, because they storyboarded it quite extensively.
Yeah.
And that was the one thing that deviated from the storyboards.
But I'm so glad that he did it and kept it in. Mm-hmm. Not only because, you know, it's a gorgeous shot just in composition, but it also works really thematically. And I think costuming also plays into this, because we're exposed for so long to her bare back, which is, of mm-hmm. course, later what ends up on the hook.
Yeah.
And I think it is subtly preparing us to be even more horrified when we see what happens to her, mm-hmm. because we've been visually, you know, reminded how vulnerable she is. Specifically on her back, you know?
Yeah.
Not that wearing a shirt is actually going to make that much of a difference, but to us, visual, because it's a visual medium, aesthetically, it does make a difference, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a good point, too, because especially in comparison to Sally, she's not as covered up. Like, Sally's got, like, the long pants, and even her shirt covers more. So it does show Pam, like, more vulnerable. I mean, from that aspect, I think you can make that case. Because, I mean, she does have the short shorts, and her outfit's a little bit more on the skin-tight side, so there's not really anything. I mean, it's not saying she's naked. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm just saying, in comparison to wardrobe, that she's a lot more out there and vulnerable.
She steps inside the house and decides, very unwisely, to look around for a bit.
Ugh.
Her luck goes from bad to worse when she stumbles into a room, like literally stumbles into a room, that is pretty much carpeted with feathers and decorated with bones and teeth.
And that poor chicken.
Why is there a chicken in, like, a birdcage?
I love that bone chair, that sofa bone situation going on. It is
it's kind of
incredible.
Cheap. Okay, so if you can make a replica, these two guys would love to purchase one. I'm putting it out there.
Well, it reminded me a lot of me and Sherry play this game called The Forest a lot.
Yes.
And the premise of that game is, like, basically you're stranded on an island and you're a survivalist. And it gets, like, so deep to the point where you can construct bone chairs and, like, little skull lamps. And I always think of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Because that
this, what is this game?
It's called The Forest. It's amazing. It's really good. It's inspired by The Descent and Cannibal Holocaust.
Okay, I can't say anything because I've gotten introduced to PlayStation this past few months. Like, someone has loaned me a PS4, so I've been playing it a lot. And there's a game. I'm drawing a blank on what it's called, but they've got add-ons where you can either play as someone trying to run away from, or you're playing as the killer. And Leatherface
Dead by
is
Daylight?
Yes, Dead by Daylight.
Oh, I love Dead by Daylight.
I've almost bought it a couple of times, but I hadn't found anybody who has played it to tell me if it's worth the money.
Yeah. It is. I love that game.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I know what I'm doing later tonight then. No, it's bad. I went from like not playing games at all to I'm on this PlayStation a couple hours every night.
Just for reference, I love Leatherface as a character in that game. And I frequently, when I play Killer, I frequently pick Leatherface because he's great.
Good to know. Thank you.
Speaking of the forest, so there are also cannibals in the forest.
Oh.
And when I said, are the Sawyers victims here? I was actually thinking about Ryan and I playing the forest recently. And we decided that we were actually the bad guys in the game. Not the cannibals.
Our plane crashes on their land and we murder them and burn their bodies and we wear their bones on our skin. So
no judgment.
And we chop down their pristine forest and yeah, we're
okay, no judgment.
Colonizers.
Well, you want to know something I do? So no judgment. You're probably going to judge me in a second. But I do play The Sims on my computer. But what I'll do sometimes if I'm just in a mood, I will make a character or avatar, whatever you want to call it, and I'll build a house. But I'll get them in there, and then I'll take out all the doors, all the windows, and I'll take away the bed, bathroom, and everything. And all they have is an espresso machine and a gnome carving table. And I don't let them sleep. I make them go insane.
That's twisted, Samantha.
I've made a murder house, too. Like this one guy, I put him in a room and there was just like one little spot of a floor and then it was like water all the way around and there was no doorway out. So all he could do was swim or stay on this little square.
Oh, I've definitely murdered some Sims in my day too.
Yeah. So like I said, there's no judgment. Like I know I'm a little twisted.
I've definitely like deleted an upstairs door because there was a Sim that just really annoyed me and he was mean to my Sim. So I was like, just going there and getting rid of the door.
Oh my God.
Yay, I'm not alone. I thought I was like really like probably need to go to a therapist, but hey, cool.
Nope. So the camera moves around the room and zooms in really interesting ways because I feel like it really emphasizes how trapped you would feel in this room.
Yeah, I was going to say, did anybody else feel like that those shots kind of went for a little bit too long at one instance?
A lot of cuts, yeah.
Pam starts to retch, but collects herself enough to run out of the room and head for the door. But unfortunately, as she runs out, Leatherface comes out from the red room and drags her back in. That is one of the most terrifying scenes I've ever seen when she makes it out to the porch and he pulls her back in and she's kicking it. Oh, God.
It's so awful. Realistic. And like she's kicking her shoes off and she is fighting for everything that she's got. But then he brings her to the meat hook.
Yeah, he takes her into his kill room, basically, with a meat hook and a freezer.
Now, for this part where he puts her up on the meat hook, Sherry, I think you and I can be like the most sympathetic about this. She was held up by a nylon cord that went between her legs, which were padded with maxi pads. That is it. Despite that padding, because, you know, it's so that's so much comfort, right, Sherry? It was still quite painful, so she decided to use that pain to make her performance more believable.
Decided or just did it?
I think later she was like, oh no, I totally decided, but in that instance she was probably like just so uncomfortable and miserable.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been there. I have had to wear some.
I was going to say, you've been hung up and held up by nylon and maxi pads?
No. I just, not that specifically. I just mean, I've been there where like we have to wear like a harness or something and it makes it really uncomfortable, you know, in certain ways. And it's, you push through it and you become really irritable, but sometimes that kind of works in your favor. That's what I relate to that feeling of like, and then later coming back and being like, oh yeah, that was, I totally used like my circumstance to my advantage, even though I was just kind of, you know, grumpy.
It was an acting decision.
So the infamous chainsaw makes its appearance for the first time as Leatherface begins to carve Kirk up while poor Pam hangs from that meat hook.
I did want to point out in the scene here, I thought it was like a really interesting choice that they intentionally make us think he's about to take that chainsaw to her. And then at the last second, he redirects to the dead body on the table already. But there's a really quick but interesting shot where he's picking up the chainsaw and it goes back to her on the hook. And the camera pans down really fast. And then for the first time, you see a bucket is below her. And that's a really chilling moment where it's like, oh my God, drain her. but then he appears at the last second.
I mean, it's essentially his little slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me the difference in the way that the men die in the movie versus the way Pam and ostensibly Sally, if she were to die, how they're treated. Like, the women are tortured way more than the men are. Like, the men get sledgehammered and die pretty much instantly.
Well, because these people get off on it.
Yeah.
It's almost, I would almost think it's, especially, it's a house of, like, demented men. I mean, no offense, but I mean, I'd almost get the thought that, or the impression that they're not going to get anything from, like, just killing the guy. I mean, that's a source of meat. But with the women, it's not just that. It's, you know, they get their rocks off from it. So they want to stretch it out and enjoy it.
Playing with your food.
Yeah, I mean, and there's also, I don't want to say it like as a cop-out or anything. I mean, part of it could also be just, I don't know, the unfortunate, like, sequence in which they encounter Leatherface.
True.
Kirk is first, so he's mm-hmm. the immediate meat. Pam is second, so she's stored for later, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's that, but I also agree, because there is, especially in the sequels, they go into this a little more overtly, like, the psychosexual nature of it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, Two sees all of them except for Leatherface, like, completely reject sex. But clearly they're, you know, getting that energy out in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is an interesting, even if, like, maybe from a movie perspective, it was just the practical element of how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the beauty of, like, discussing movies, is themes and everything can be unintentional, but still, you know, be there and be real.
Yeah.
Right.
The Hardesty siblings and Jerry are waiting by the van as the sun is starting to set. And Jerry is taunting Franklin.
But see, like, wasn't Jerry kind of an ass in this scene? I mean,
100%.
Don't really care for Franklin at this point either, but Jerry was just an ass.
Yeah. He's like, the hitchhiker's coming for you. He's going to kill you. Oh, I told him your name.
Isn't that reminiscent of Barbara and her brother at the beginning of Night of the Living Dead?
Oh, yeah.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Jerry says he's going to go head down to the creek to find Pam and Kirk before it gets too dark.
Fine, I'd leave his ass.
There's a lot of bickering at this point between Sally and Franklin, and it really comes across as this, like, sibling, like, just regular sibling bickering. Jerry finds his way to the farmhouse, and he notices, just before he's about to leave, because he doesn't get an answer at the door, he notices the blanket that Pam and Kirk had taken with them, kind of hanging on the porch railing.
Which I will kind of give him some snaps for his power of observation. However, don't go in the house.
Hearing noises and laughter from inside the house, he thinks they're just playing a prank on him, so he heads in. He enters the kill room, but Kirk and Pam are nowhere to be seen.
Mm.
He hears this knocking sound coming from the chest freezer. So he opens it up to find Pam inside.
Okay, now, I was a little confused by this, because you hear the knocking from inside the freezer, but when he opens it, she looks like she's passed out until all of a sudden her eyes open. So are we supposed to believe she was the one banging on the inside of it? Or I'm very confused. This confused me probably more than it should have, I guess.
It's a little strange. Yeah, you could just chalk it up to her twitching or kicking in her sleep or in her past.
I guess, but it sounded like, well, I mean, that's a good point. I thought it sounded like knocking, but then I was very confused when he opened it and she's like kind of almost turned in to the other side. But I did read somewhere that the actress felt that Pam got away and survived at that moment.
Oh, well,
I
doubt it.
Doubt it. Yeah, I was like, I doubt it. But because, I mean, he shoves her back in.
I mean, she was part of, like, the Kirby brigade before Kirby was even there.
I want that on a t-shirt. Kirby brigade. I like that. Yes. So she convulses, sits up violently before flopping down on the edge of the freezer, and Jerry kind of backs up in shock just in time to see Leatherface in the doorway. And that scream is real.
Oh, yeah. That's another one. That was his first encounter.
And last.
And he didn't even really register that it was acting. Like, he just saw Leatherface, got scared, and his natural instinct was to go for the door.
Yeah, because he was originally supposed to be yanked backwards by an off-camera crew member.
Yeah.
So there was actually a crew member that was holding onto his belt, and he was supposed to yank him backwards.
Mm-hmm.
But Alan Denzinger just, like, kind of freaked out and, like, ran towards the door because he was so scared.
Yeah.
So Leatherface hits him hard with that sledgehammer before returning to shut Pam back in the freezer. So I'm sorry, Terry McGinn. I don't think Pam escaped. So this is when we see, like, Leatherface and his vulnerability, because he's really scared by this influx of intruders. Mm-hmm. So he runs to the front door, to the front window, and he, like, opens the curtains to see if more threats are incoming. And then he kind of, like, consoles himself.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you point that out, too, because we'll see later when Sally encounters him and she screams, he is actually startled.
Yeah.
In an interview, Gunnar Hansen actually stated that he saw Leatherface as completely under the control of his family. He'll do whatever they tell him to do. He's a little bit afraid of them. And you can really see that here and later on as well.
Mm-hmm.
Night has fallen. It is a full moon. Sally and Franklin are still waiting by the van, and they debate going to find them. Franklin's like, let's go back to the gas station. But Sally's like, no, I'm going to go and see them. But Franklin, not wanting to be left behind, follows her.
What would you do in this situation?
Oh, I would not stay by myself. I would probably go with whoever was going.
I would say, I don't know. I feel like I'd probably end up saying, you have fun. I'll just wait here in case they come back. I'm not fucking with that wilderness.
Right. Like, no, Joe, if I had the keys, I would be taking that car. But like Franklin says later, they took the keys. Yeah. I still don't know if I would have left the car.
I would have definitely fought as adamantly as I could to stay at the car.
Yeah.
But if we don't have the keys and the other person actually starts walking away, I'm going with them because I'm not staying by myself. Like, I know myself well enough to absolutely know that that's how I'm responding.
I mean, I would like to say I would stay in the car by myself, but at the same time, I know in that situation, I'd be so scared to be by myself, even if I felt like it was against my better judgment to go.
I'd be upset with them the whole time, but...
And especially he is vulnerable. I mean, they're all vulnerable, but he is especially in comparison. He can't run. He can't really, I mean, he could kind of fight, I guess, to a point, but...
But they're also in an area where, like, it's not like there's flat surfaces that his wheelchair is really going to roll around on easily. So it's even going to be difficult for him to get anywhere, right? And we even see that, like, earlier in the movie and again now. They have one flashlight between them and they see a light in the distance and they're like, oh, good, it's a house. But before they make it to the house, Franklin hears something. Is that a chainsaw?
Famous last words, literally.
Yes, it is. So Leatherface comes at Franklin with the chainsaw.
That shot is just, wow.
Awesome. It's so cool. Because
he's got the flashlight in his lap, so all you see is the chainsaw. I mean, it is done really well. That, I would say, is probably one of the top, like, killing scene in a movie ever.
And apparently, what they did was, and I'm trying to remember who said this. I think it was the sound guy. He said that they didn't want to have a lot of gushy sounds for this scene. So they said... He said, you have the chainsaw going full speed, then you have Franklin yelling, the blade hitting the metal really needed to cut through. In that moment, you didn't need any gush. It was actually great fun shooting this scene.
Hmm.
We sort of see blood, not a lot of it, but as Leatherface is attacking Franklin and the camera is in the wheelchair POV, we needed some blood splash. So Dottie Pearl, the makeup person, would get mouthfuls of stage blood and spit it at Gunner from over the cameraman's right shoulder.
Ew.
Cool.
But that wasn't enough blood, so then Toby Hooper started doing the same thing over the cameraman's left shoulder. This still wasn't enough blood, so while he was holding the boom, he was also spitting fake blood over the camera, being careful not to get it on the lens. So there were three of them just spitting mouthfuls of fake blood, and so you get this light spray in the final shot.
Okay, I feel really bad for Gunner just having these people spit on him. For $405 of 4 weeks of work and to get spit on.
I mean, teach their own.
It reminds me of that anecdote from Friday the 13th, of Kevin Bacon's death, where there was a malfunction with, like, the blood machine.
Yes. Oh,
The special effects guy had to, like, blow the tube, and it ended up in this weird spurt of blood, but that became iconic, of course. But it just reminds me of that. But, like, the Friday the 13th one, a little less gross example.
Yeah, I mean, to each their own, but I wouldn't want three different people spitting on me. Couldn't pay me for that.
I mean, well,
you could pay me for that.
Some people would pay for that.
That's some insight into you there.
There's very little I would not do for money.
If you really want to say that out where it's going to be out in the world for people to know that about you.
I support it. I support it.
You need something done. If you pay me enough money, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with people knowing that.
Respect.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Respect.
I have student loans I need to pay off eventually.
That's true.
I feel like such an oddball with this grouping.
We get this incredible shot of Sally bathed in blue moonlight before she starts running through the woods. And this chase scene and the slightly shorter chase scene at the end of the movie, they're so intense.
Yeah, they feel like they last forever.
Yes.
But if you watch Leatherface, it's kind of comical because Gunnar Hansen's stride was so long that no matter how fast she ran, he could catch up to her. So he was constantly finding things to like...
I noticed that with the hitchhiker in that second chase scene too. He was basically like right up on her, but just kind of like dancing around her.
Yeah, it's just having to find like stupid things to like distract him or trip over or something. Because like even my dad was telling me when he saw the movie in the theaters, he was like, you know, the guy goes right, but then he turns around and goes left. I was like, well, Dad, he had to like kill time because this girl wasn't running fast enough.
So Sally runs right to Leatherface's home. She thinks she's going to find some kind of sanctuary there, but instead just finds more horror. And her running up to the house and banging on the door, crying, "Somebody help me," is so sad because you know, we know as the audience that she's not going to get help here.
And I get like being maybe in that moment, you're too scared to like really think properly, but I would kind of stop for a second and be like, okay, if there's a guy out there with a chainsaw, he's probably going to live here. I mean, this is the closest place. He's not, I mean, you know what I mean? So but I get to, if you're like in that moment and you're terrified, you're not thinking straight, but I don't know.
So at this point, both Leatherface and Sally make bad decisions. She runs up to the attic, which if she knew Sidney Prescott.
You never go upstairs.
But Leatherface decides he doesn't want to use the door handle and instead starts slicing into the door. And he is going to get in trouble later on for that.
Look what you did to the door.
Well, I did think that I saw Sally lock the door, but I felt like it would have been a lot faster for Leatherface to just kick the door in than just saw it into pieces.
Look, he was having fun with his toy.
He doesn't get to use it much. That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. Let him enjoy it.
At this point, we get very much shades of Psycho as Sally in the attic meets Grandma and Grandpa wearing their Sunday best, who appear to be in varying stages of mummification.
Grandpa makes my skin crawl.
100%.
He is both the funniest and most disturbing member of the family at the same time.
He is. And don't forget, there's the mummified remains of the family pet. And I can't tell if it's a dog or a cat.
Oh, yeah.
You probably don't want to know.
No, probably not.
It's an armadillo.
They're just running rampant out there, you know?
Presented with such horrors, what do? You run back downstairs. So Sally starts running back downstairs. She is met about halfway down the stairs by Leatherface. And they both startle each other. So she turns back around and decides jumping out a window is a better option than staying here. Literally has no hesitation.
Right. And the thing is, for this scene, Toby hired a stunt woman to jump through the window. So all Marilyn Burns had to do was film her landing. She hurt herself filming the landing. I mean, like...
They hired a stunt person and then, yeah.
And that's how she... $405. Was it worth it?
And she says that's why she's limping at the end of the movie, too, is because...
She hurt herself.
With Leatherface swiftly on her heels, she picks herself up and she just keeps running. She makes it to the gas station, gets in through a back door when the front door's locked, and she meets the gas station guy from earlier in the movie. She begs him to call the police, but he's like, oh, we don't have a phone, but it's okay. We'll get in the truck. We'll drive to the nearest town. So he goes out to get the truck. She sees that famous gas station barbecue sizzling away. He pulls the truck up. He reenters the room now carrying a sack. Our nice gas station attendant isn't so nice after all. He is actually a member of the family. This is Drayton Sawyer, also known as the cook, brother to both Leatherface and the hitchhiker, a.k.a. Nubbins.
This, I remember seeing this scene when I saw it for the first time as a young kid, because it's so distressing. Like, you think safety, finally. Like, she's in somewhere, she's away. And then he brings the bag out, and it's just, and this movie, from like the chase scene, from when that chase scene starts when Franklin dies on to the last shot of the movie, it's just like constant distress.
Yeah.
It's a barrage of distress. Yeah.
It's just like high tension.
It feels like a physical weight on you while you're watching.
And it's really good at misdirecting you, because I feel like you don't get the, like the gas station attendant, when he's first talking to him, he's like, don't go to people's houses. Like, you're going to get hurt. Like, and he does seem genuinely like a genuinely nice guy. And so like for this to kind of turn and him to be part of this, like it's actually quite shocking. Like, I think the first time you see it.
And there's a line later on where he says something like, he doesn't like to kill. And then he's like, you know, you got to do something. You don't have to like do it. So maybe you could, if you choose to see a little glimmer of hope, you can maybe choose to believe that he actually wouldn't mind if they had gotten away. But when, you know, she ran into his arms, he was like, well, we got to do it. We got to eat.
Well, and I think his other thing was, if the kids had just like driven off, they wouldn't have messed with them. But once, you know, they start going one by one, you can't let anyone from the group leave, because then they're going to report a person missing.
Totally.
And so it's also about their own survival.
Which I think is why initially he's like, don't go to your grandfather's house. Like, don't go to old houses. Like, just go, just keep driving. Right. Cause he's like, this is how I can save them. And we're not in any danger, and not save them, but here's how we can kind of, you know, avoid what I think will inevitably happen.
Like, I'm going to put this out into the universe, and if they show up, then it's their own fault, because I have given them the out to not go there and to stay away. If they choose to still go and they encounter, well, then that's just how it was supposed to happen.
Yeah, there is a little bit of a, I used this word earlier in a different context, but like a practicality element to it almost, where he's like, ah, they're here. And like you said, like, we need to eat. And I do think he of the family finds it the most unpleasant. I mean, I think that's clear. But he's also the cook. So like there's a dichotomy there, which I think is evident of like the family not being necessarily all right, you know, like.
Well, and I almost wonder too if part of it is kind of like how with the cabin in the woods, where they could get them to a certain point, but it had to ultimately be their decision. So he gives them the option, but it's ultimately their decision. So they bring it on themselves, almost like how he can maybe justify it to himself. I've warned them. I said, don't go there. They've been told don't go into people's houses. They did it anyway.
So Sally grabs a knife, but he makes short work of it when he basically swats at her quite violently with a broom.
He likes that broom.
He loves that broom. He knocks her out. He ties her up before covering her with the sack and putting her in his truck.
And that rag he shoves in her mouth.
The little throwaway line after he goes back into the gas station to turn off the lights and lock up. And he comes back and he's like, the cost of electricity is enough to drive a man out of business.
Oh, but that's why we're going to have like a generator constantly going.
He's this weird mix of oddly comforting and taunting, because he's poking her with a stick while telling her to calm down as he laughs to himself.
It's horrifying.
And as they're driving, he sees Nubbins in the road and scolds him, telling him to stay away from the graveyard. You almost got caught. So Nubbins gets in the back of the truck and they head home. Nubbins at this point has tied Sally up. He's gleefully poking at her as well. And Drayton tells them to bring Grandpa down for supper. So Sally is bound and gagged, and we get these really weird camera angles and close-ups. Like, there's one from the ground, one looking down on her. And it really adds to the disorientation and discomfort that she is clearly feeling. Like, it really brings you in to that moment for Sally.
Yeah, and there's a moment too where she, I think it's early on in the dinner scene, where she is just like screaming and crying and everything, and everyone at the table starts like imitating her / almost like howling, and it's so awful.
This scene just stresses me out so much.
Oh, for sure. And Ryan and I were talking about it a couple days ago, and we were talking about how like this scene seems like it goes on for so long because it's so intense, but I think it's like 12 minutes. Like, it actually is not a very long scene.
However, like, these poor actors, too, this, I think they filmed this for something like 23 hours. And it was, okay, so during this filming this scene, it was broad daylight outside with no air conditioning inside the house. So they had to have blackout curtains, which made the house even hotter. So the temperature inside would sometimes get up to like 120 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't know what that is for you, Sherry. Sorry. And because of that, all of the animal bones and carcasses that were real, it would then make it smell like it was unbearable. And then they also had the burning in the back too. So can you imagine just how uncomfortable, like that scene is already tense to begin with. And then you're tired. This is towards the end of everything. It's the climactic scene. And then you've got that to deal with on top of it.
Yeah.
And it just,
Their budget was so low that they couldn't afford like a ton of costumes for everyone. So like Leatherface was wearing the same shirt apparently for the entire shoot. So it was apparently rank by the time they were shooting this scene.
By the end of it, people did not want to be near him in that costume. And Marilyn Byrne, the woman who plays Sally, she would sneak her costume home to wash it and she would get in trouble for it because it would mess with continuity.
So Leatherface though clearly loves his grandpa. He's got this kind of weird tender moment. Once Grandpa's brought down from the attic, Leatherface kind of pats him gently on the shoulder and then kisses him a couple of times on top of the head, which I think again lends to that idea of Leatherface as like a child.
Mm-hmm.
But Grandpa has teeth.
Oh, I hate this part so much.
It's awful. They stretch out Sally's arm and they slice open her finger, letting Grandpa, aka Grand Dracula, drink her blood.
My favorite Thanksgiving tradition.
And this scene, like, just what happens just turns my stomach anyway. But then I was reading, too, while researching, that the prop that was supposed to, like, gush out the blood on her finger kept malfunctioning. And they were so tired and so frustrated that without the crew's knowledge, I don't even know if the woman who played Sally even knew this was going to happen, but Gunner cut her finger. Like, that is her blood in that take. And then to just...
I actually think it's Toby Hooper's hand in the shot, but...
Oh, no. Everything I've read has said it was her hand that they cut her finger.
No. Sorry. I meant he was the one holding... Sorry. Yes, that was her hand. I meant I think he's the one who actually cut, like, in the shot. That's what I understood it to be.
Oh, no. Because I have an interview here where Gunnar Hansen said that the tube with the fake blood kept clogging, and at that point he was just so tired that they were all just insane. So his only desire at that point was to get it done. So he didn't care about her well-being, and he cut her hand. And that he noted in this interview that there isn't much acting going on in the dinner scene. Like, they were all just going that insane by this point.
I know in the commentary they like mention that Marilyn was so, she didn't even notice, like, until later, because she was so exhausted.
Oh, I believe it.
So hot. And I'm like, yeah, you know. Well, also, the funny thing about, like, I don't know if you guys have ever been stabbed, but...
Can't say that I have.
You don't actually feel it. It doesn't really feel like anything, actually. So I also totally believe it, especially given everything else going on around her.
Mm-hmm.
Totally makes sense. Like...
You might think that Grandpa's dead based on, you know, mummified Grandma and, you know, how mummified he looks. But he is definitely alive because he joyously sucks Sally's blood. Like, he is into this.
Oh, God. I just want to...
How old do you think he is?
100?
I don't know.
I actually read somewhere, too, that there was some question if he was really the grandfather. Like, the family is so twisted, like... Because I think I read somewhere he was written originally as an older brother.
Damn.
But still, like, that man's, like, how is he still alive?
Blood, apparently. Blood is life. As vampires will tell you.
Yeah.
Sally, not surprisingly, passes out and wakes up later to find herself at dinner with the Sawyers. She immediately begins screaming. And this is what you mentioned, Ryan, where they are howling at her, like, mockingly in return. And there's a plate of food in front of her. Like, that's considerate of them. I mean, not
well. They're a good old Southern Texas family. She is a guest.
That's true. She begs Drayton, recognizes that Drayton is the most...
He seems to be the one calling the shots.
She's like, you could make them stop. And Leatherface and Nubbins get closer to her, and she is freaking out as they are touching her face and her hair. At this point, Nubbins makes the mistake of calling Drayton just the cook while the other two do all the work. They do all the killing. And this starts a family squabble. Drayton, as we mentioned, says that he finds no pleasure in killing, but there's some things you have to do. Doesn't mean you have to like it. Sally continues to beg and scream, and we get these extreme close-ups of her face and eventually like these extreme close-ups of her eyes. So you can literally see every speck of color.
I mean, you see like the red veins and the
Sally's time has run out. They're like, it is time, but they're going to let Grandpa, who was the best slaughterer at the slaughterhouse, have a go at it.
This man can't do it. Like, how he's even sitting up in a chair right now is beyond me.
Now, this is the one moment where I will say, yes, I can see the comedic
value
of this, but it's still harrowing. Well,
I mean, it is still disturbing.
Yes.
The whole concept of it is disturbing. But I feel like the execution is just so, there is something inherently funny about watching an old man drop a hammer several times. Yes. Even though, like, again, in context, horrifying.
Yeah.
But, like, it is a little, I mean, that was one of the pleasures of bringing this scene to the stage, but keeping basically everything exactly the same, with the exception that I switched out a couple members of the family for some of the family members that were a little more alive in the sequence.
It is,
you know, a stage, and you still want it to be a little bigger, and that was, you know, so the concessions were made. But it was just so fun watching, you know, in the movie, the grandpa, who's really played by this, like, 19-year-old,
really?
Hammer. Yeah, he was like the youngest person in the cast.
Interesting. How did I miss that?
I don't know, but I think it's really fun.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
There's a really funny picture where he's getting his makeup done. So he's like old dude head, and he's not wearing a shirt, but it's like super young body. It's hilarious.
Interesting. I wonder how I missed that through all my research. Interesting.
It was just, yeah. And then seeing, you know, my actor, who also at the time was like 19, and just being like, I'm an old man, dropping the hammer. And it was, I just think there's a lot to be mined there, and I think they mined it.
Drayton goes off on this tangent about what a great master of the sledgehammer Grandpa is before they untie Sally, bring her to his feet, and they're holding her head over a blood bucket. As we've mentioned, Grandpa can't hold that sledgehammer without assistance, so they're all trying to like help him out. And after multiple attempts, Nubbins, who is basically holding Sally, he gets distracted because he's like, I'm going to help Grandpa. And she manages to get free and jumps out of another window. Luckily, this one's on the ground floor. She just starts running away with both Nubbins and Leatherface in pursuit. She makes it to the road. Nubbins pretty much has her, and he is slashing at her back with his knife, but a cattle truck intervenes and runs over Nubbins.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh.
No, it's a fantastic, like, it's a good ending for Nubbins.
It's actually, there's also a little comedy here with the first truck driver who gets out and runs away. And it's like, oh no, what happened to him?
I know. That's exactly what I was going to say. Like that, like, I'm like, he just keeps running. And does Leatherface catch up to him later? Like, I hope not.
What I think is that Leatherface is too involved in his tantrum to notice when this other guy sneaks back to his truck and drives back away.
I hope so.
But also then that guy is going to have to be like, explain to people like, hey, why is there like meat stuck in your wheels? Like,
I will say, when you're like 6 and it doesn't look very real today, but yeah, that scene of him getting hit by the semi fucked me up real bad for a long time. Like, I remembered that one for a while.
So the truck driver and Sally managed to get away from Leatherface, partially because the truck driver has a killer wrench tossing arm and he hits Leatherface in the head. Leatherface goes down and he hits himself in the leg with his chainsaw.
So his screaming at that point, that's legit because they had like a metal plate or something on his leg to block the chainsaw. but it was still causing him pain because the friction would cause the plate to get very hot and it burned his leg. So that's Leatherface screaming. That is legit pain.
Yeah, he thought he was actually hit by the chainsaw.
Yeah.
Sally and the truck driver keep running. Leatherface limps after them, but luckily a pickup truck comes by. And Sally, covered in blood, manages to climb into the bed of the truck as Leatherface approaches close behind. And then we have not one, but two absolutely iconic images to end the movie. We have Sally covered in blood, laughing hysterically. It's like this laugh sob as she escapes in the back of the truck, and Leatherface swinging his chainsaw and basically dancing in circles.
Now, this was actually Gunnar Hansen venting his anger and frustration on set due to the grueling production, but Hooper just let the cameras keep rolling and used it.
I love the end because it's just like, it's such a shitty, long, heavy thing that she just went through. It's like, and she looks so broken at the end. I hate to say it, but it's almost like, would it have been better if she just died? Because how do you move on from that?
It's not a happy ending, right? Like, yeah, she physically escaped, but...
And so that's the end of the movie. What makes this a great horror movie for you?
For me, I think it's just a perfect storm of a bunch of little things, intentional and maybe unintentional. I think maybe he intended there to be a little more comedy and it just doesn't show through because there's so much horror. I think it's just beautiful. And the music, I mean, it's not music. The scoring is one of my favorite things in movies ever. It's like in Hereditary, there's like this thumping heartbeat bass that plays through most of the movie and you can't really hear it unless you're wearing headphones. And it's that kind of shit that I really like. And with all the industrial slaughterhouse sounds, there's just, it's a perfect storm. Good performances, good shots, pure horror. I mean, it's fucked up and I love it. Like a top, I think it's a top five for me. It would be The Descent, Hereditary, Rosemary's Baby, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, they're just awesome.
I mean, I think that because of the potential of it could actually happen, it's not a monster. It's not a creature. It's not magic. It's not anything of that nature. It is fucked up people and you're stuck in their world and you can't get out.
No one escapes. Like Sally doesn't escape intact. Like she physically escapes, but mentally she doesn't.
Yes, it's supposed to say like at what cost.
It's the tagline, right? Yeah. Who will escape and what will be left of them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is left of Sally is her husk.
Yeah. And we can glean all that just from her like amazing performance at the end.
Oh my gosh. It's absolutely brilliant. She's incredible at the end. Well, she's incredible through the whole thing, but she is
believable.
The ending is, yeah.
Even just absolutely. In her eyes, the way that she's not really blinking, like, you know, she's laughing, like in that very unsettling way when people laugh, but their eyes are wide open.
It's like,
you know,
a crazy laugh.
Exactly. And it is. She's snapped. To answer the question, though, like, it's simplicity, I think, for me, in terms of why this is such a good horror movie. Simplicity, atmosphere, it all just kind of works together. And kind of regardless of intention, like, at some point for me, watching this movie, the intention fades away when I'm actually watching it. And I just am so engrossed in what's happening that it just feels like we're there. You know, it feels like we shouldn't be watching it. It almost feels, you know, at points like, ooh, like snuff almost, like, oh, I shouldn't be seeing this.
Yeah. Right.
That's a good point. That's kind of, I think, what I was getting at earlier when I was like, I felt weird, like, watching it and enjoying it while my fiance was just kind of looking over his shoulder at me. And, yeah, you put it into better words. It feels like, yeah, very snuffy almost.
I'm going to ask you now if you think that it can be categorized as folk horror.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
I think if we look at some other examples of folk horror today, one of the most popular examples of a modern folk horror movie is Midsommar. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of similarities in story to Midsommar. But I mean, also earlier, I said that I think this movie is like the perfect American fairy tale. And, you know, folk tales are just, it's just, you know, a different way to say the same thing about a story. It's about, you know, people. It's about a place. It's very specific in what it's doing, but it's simple enough to be, you know, you could relay this story in a couple sentences, and it's, you know, you're not going to miss a lot of like the important story beats. But it's about a post-apocalyptic Texas where, you know, the people have been driven to cannibalism because they can no longer sustain themselves with what little they are given, you know, by the system.
And there is like a lot of the isolation. I mean, the family themselves are isolated from civilization. They're isolated from society. And then these teenagers, I guess they're teenagers, I don't know how they're supposed to be, but like they're even isolated out there. I mean, there's no help.
Yeah. I don't necessarily want to speak to folk horror too much because I haven't seen too much of it, but I would say if you look at slashers and the general trend of how the slasher goes, I think the big difference here is that we absolutely do not enjoy any of the kills. And I think in slashers, it's kind of like, I mean, we love the Scream movies and how stabby they are. And a lot of slasher movies will put us in a position to root for the killer by, you know, we'll get some scenes of some teen being a real jerk, and then when they get stabbed later everyone cheers. And it's like in this movie, you don't enjoy any of it.
Yeah, there's a fun element missing.
Yes.
Yeah, that you do traditionally get in most slashers. Yeah, I would agree with that. I actually saw somebody refer to it as a post-60s version of Hansel and Gretel, and I thought that was like that was like right on the nose. I'm like, that's actually kind of perfect. I also like, for me, like the kind of the mirror image of the family. So you have like Sally and Franklin and their grandfather who was closely tied to the slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. Then you have the Sawyers, who you have the grandfather and then the bickering siblings. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of this weird inversion of each other.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And like, I that's something that really like stuck with me the last few times that I've watched it. And I don't think you can argue, like, this is probably one of the most influential horror movies of the 70s. It's got to be at least in the top five of, like, influential horror movies.
Definitely.
For sure, especially if we, like, think just North America, right? But even internationally, like, think about how many, like, filmmakers we were talking about earlier who mentioned this movie. You know, between this and Black Christmas and Halloween, you know,
yeah,
we get the formula for a slasher, even though this less so, I think, because this, I don't even know if I'd call Texas Chainsaw a slasher. It doesn't
feel like a traditional slasher.
It misses enough of what I would call the hallmarks of slasherdom to not exactly be the same as a slasher. For one, I think the kills happen too infrequently, and they start happening too late into the movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's that element. I mean, of course, there's exceptions to that, but we like without even a cold open kill, you know, it's a long time before we start, you know, losing the teens. Yeah. And I don't know. It feels like a pre slasher maybe almost, or proto slasher maybe it's better, more. Mm-hmm. Technical term for it.
And I also think you're probably more inclined to be aligned with folk horror if you let the landscape serve as much as a character in the film as the villain itself, yeah. Which this one very much so does.
A quick question, to go back to the very beginning of the movie, because for some reason it just made me think of this. So at the very beginning, when they're talking about the grave robbing, is the implication that like they are responsible for the grave robbing, or are they just linking the two in like, look at all these grisly, gruesome things that are happening in this area?
Well, I thought the older brother made a comment to Nubbins about you weren't supposed to.
Oh, right. Yes. Hanging out at the graveyard. Yeah.
So I just assumed it was him doing his art.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same.
That was very obvious, and I'm going to hit myself.
Well, I mean, it, no, because it does make sense to also be like, it's just other random grave robbers. If we think about like how Texas is being portrayed in this movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
I used the words post-apocalyptic earlier, which is something I grabbed from Toby Hooper in one of his commentaries of this movie, talking about how he literally wanted, because it felt like an apocalypse was the reason for the movie, you know, with everything going on in the early 70s, mm-hmm. he wanted to shoot Texas like an apocalypse had taken place, and like the stragglers are behaving in ways that are not, you know, ideal. Yeah. And then also it reminds us that like the Sawyers are not the only people that are harmed by, you know, the kind of economic anxieties that turn them into cannibals.
Right.
You know, it's a little more, I think, simple than that in actual terms, because it probably was just Nubbins robbing the graves, but there's different interpretations, I guess.
For sure.
So body count, 4, unless you count Nubbins, and then there's 5. I mean, Sally's mental state is also 1. So how many scaredy cat screams? So if you were to rate it on a scale of 1 to 5, what would you rate it?
5.
4. But I mean, as far as like being scared, I would say lower.
I mean, I'd say it's a full on 5, because it's just one of those movies. And my thing is, I watch the same movies over and over all the time. That's just what I do. And this is one of those movies where it's like every time I watch it, I'm never any less uncomfortable. And I think that's an achievement.
There are very few movies that make me feel that way. The Descent is one of them.
Love it.
This is another for sure. Quick question. Sequels and remakes. Are there any that you like? Any that stand out for you?
I like the remake. Like I said, I drugged my poor father to see it when I was like 18 when it first came out. And he said that he felt as though the remake was what they would have wanted to accomplish had they had like the budget and the means to do so back in the 70s.
I'm kind of like a notorious sequel hater. I mean, there's always exceptions, really, of course. Like, I love all the Scream movies, including this new one that just came out. But yeah, generally, especially with slashers, I feel the sequels always bring down what was so effective about the first one. So I've never really clicked with any of these Texas Chainsaw sequels. I saw the remake years ago, like years and years. And I remember not hating it. So I probably should at some point go back and rewatch that. But as for the other ones, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I could do without the sequels, like especially the Next Generation one with Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey. Like, I kind of wish that one just didn't exist. No offense to them. But no, I like the remake, but like all the sequels, even the subsequent sequels of the remake, I could do without.
Yeah, for sure.
I recently went on the Bomb Squad podcast to rank all the Texas Chainsaw movies. So I you know, I've been thinking about the series as a whole quite a bit recently. I, for one, love most of these movies. I would say I think 6 out of 8 of them are good. The only ones I don't like are the Texas Chainsaw Massacre: The Beginning, which is the prequel to the remake, mm-hmm. and then 3, which is Leatherface, Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3, because it's just kind of boring.
It is boring.
It is. It's just really boring. But I also want to say, like, if I may, in my top 5, like, movies of all time, both the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 are on that list.
Wow.
Like, I think 1 and 2 are, like, a perfect duology thematically, because they both, I mean, yeah, they take very opposite directions in execution, but they make so much sense when you're analyzing them and really thinking about them through the critical lens of Vietnam, especially.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just really appreciate that. And then, yeah, like, Next Generation is silly, but still entertaining in a way. I think the remake is really good, actually. Granted, I actually like a lot of the remakes from the 2000s. I don't know if it's because, you know, those were often the ones I was exposed to first. Mm. But I just happen to think a lot of them are good. You know, Nightmare on Elm Street notwithstanding, but
like you know,
this one I think is good. Friday, Halloween, all those are at least interesting to me.
At least with the remake, you could say more than one person got attacked by the chainsaw.
That's true. Actually, that's true of pretty much all the sequels. They really up the chainsaw, like importance to the story.
It's probably like a big note that they got after the first one was released. Like, excuse me,
you promised the Chainsaw Massacre.
This is no.
Texas Chainsaw 3D is wild and a fun ride. I think it's really funny and also really gory.
Derek, I'm on your side. I actually enjoy most of the sequels other than three. I have not seen the remake, so I need to see that.
Oh, yeah, you should. I think it's...
Oh, yeah. At least see it once.
But two, the first time I saw it, I was like, what am I watching? This is so weird. But I've come around on it. Like, I think I enjoy it more. Like, I mean, Bill Moseley is amazing in it. And Stretch is awesome.
So, Stretch is my favorite final girl in the series.
Yeah.
I love Stretch.
She's so good.
I don't love Caroline Williams that much, but I do love Stretch.
Yeah, fair enough.
She blocked me on Twitter, so there's...
She blocked you on Twitter?
Yeah. you know, she said something racist, and I was like, hey, this is racist, and then she blocked me. But does not take away from my love of Stretch as a character whatsoever. I think just because Stretch is the character I relate to most, probably in the entire series, or maybe not relate to, but I think is most similar.
I also love the chili cook-off at the beginning. Like,
it's fun.
So bonkers.
Like, oh, when that lady bites into a tooth, and he's like, "It's corn chip."
Ew! Oh my gosh!
Brilliant. So, thank you for coming on and talking about a movie that obviously is near and dear to all of us. So, tell us where we can find you.
I'm at. I just got a new website, actually. I forgot about it. It's at ryanmills.art, and that's where all my illustration work and all the little buttons that'll take you to my other places are. So that's just probably the easiest place.
Yeah, I'm still just on Instagram at amethyst_heart1018. But aside from that, not too much else really going on.
I'm on Insta at Derek Spooks and on Twitter at DerekSykes17. You can also... check out my podcast, And That's It, featuring Juno and Derek. As I said, Sherry was on. We talked about Nightmare 3 and 4, Dream Warriors, and Dream Master. And that was such a fun conversation.
It really was.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely... If you check out none of the other episodes, definitely check out the episode with Sherry, because it was really fun.
That whole series that you did was really good. Like, I really liked the, like, Friday the 13th Nightmare on Elm Street discussions. It was great.
Yeah, they were a lot of fun.
Do you have, like, a season planned coming up, or?
Yeah. I mean, we've been on hiatus for a little bit, but our season 4, we've actually recorded a couple episodes already. We are going to be focusing on, like, the movies that have made us, like, movies from our youth, childhood that really affected important moments of our lives. We'll be talking about, like, the first movie that ever scared us, the first movie that we saw, like, on a date, stuff like that. So,
oh, I love it.
It's a wild collection of movies that includes everything from Seed of Chucky to Step Up 2 to Batman v Superman. So check it out when we start releasing episodes.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us today. You can catch us on Twitter at CatScaredy and on Instagram at ScaredyCatsThePodcast. Subscribe wherever you find podcasts, and don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. Until next time, stay scared.